limited time to grieve. Everyone, even June, always assumed she was their favorite. She was certainly the good one, the one who gave them little cause to worry over the years. But she is beginning to suspect that they would be able to make peace more easily with her untimely death for that very reason. Kath was a work in progress, so many of life's most basic milestones left undone, stuck in a nowhere job she was about to lose, incapable of getting her act together to enroll in the local community college, no matter how much she talked about it. Kath and her castles in the air. The day before she had died, she had called June with questions about high-end finishes in kitchens, which ones were worth the money, which could be skipped. She said she was thinking about buying a townhouse in a new development near the marsh, and there were upgrade options. June asked her how she could possibly afford it, and Kath said, coyly, June thinks now, that she was a better saver than anyone gave her credit for, that tip money had been coming in like a bumper crop this summer. Yet her boss confirmed to Jim that he was going to let Kath go, or at least cut her hours way back, although he also insisted he had not yet told her that. He had been maddeningly unapologetic about his disloyalty to her, indifferent to the protocols of death, in which people agree to act as if the deceased were a better person than she was. "I can't afford two waitresses off-season," he said. "I pitch in, or my wife does." Could Kath's death have been a suicide attempt? June wonders, leaning against the stove, waiting to see if her parents will eat anything. She cannot imagine her wayward, intense sister taking her own life. But she can envision Kath staging a scene. For effect, getting down on her hands and knees and sticking her head in the oven, then getting bored at her own dramatics. She had done things like that when they were children. Once, on April Fool's Day, she had spread ketchup on herself and sprawled at the bottom of the stairs for June, only 7 at the time, to find her. She hadn't been fooled for long, but the image still lives in her head. When she has nightmares about Kath, and she has 2-3 a week, that's what she sees, a 10-year-old covered in blood. She feels guilty that she can still go about daily life in a way her parents cannot. She loved her sister, of course, but Kath was exhausting, absorbing so much attention and time. June settled and happy, felt more and more like Kath's second mother. Kath had begun to borrow money here and there, small amounts, but June kept this secret from Jim. She has a lot of practice keeping Kath's secrets. The family never spoke about the accident, a word that lives in quotations in June's head because she knows the law. If you attack someone, leap at the person with teeth bared and hands ready to strike, you have intent, even if you're not trying to put them in a wheelchair for life. Yet, if the family had dared to discuss this taboo topic, June would never have told them the connection she made long ago. Kath jumped on that girl a week after June won 3 awards at her middle school graduation ceremony. June has long believed that Kath yearned to leap at her, punch her, and hit her for being the effortlessly good girl. But it wasn't effortless. It was the only role left to her as hellion Kath burned her path through adolescence. When June was a teenager, it felt as if every conversation with her parents started with an almost absent-minded congratulations on June's latest achievement, then quickly moved to the problem of Kath. What should they do about Kath? Oh, June believes this woman killed Kath, but the quiet, analytical part of June's mind, honed by hours of listening to court testimony, can't help wondering if Kath provoked her. "Eat," she urges her parents, who move their soup spoons through their bowls but fail to raise them to their mouths. The goldfish crackers she sprinkled along the surface have bloated and sunk. This was how June and Kath had eaten tomato soup when they were little, putting so many goldfish in their bowls that you could barely see what they called the Red Sea. The trick was to eat them quickly, while they still had a little crunch and snap. She had thought it might comfort her parents, this unacknowledged callback to a simpler time. Because by the time Kath was 11 or 12, it was clear she was not going to have an easy life. She wasn't self-destructive, but she was destructive. Things broke around Kath, things and people. Accidents, her parents always said. Kath had accidents. But not everything was an accident. There had been a set of china, their paternal grandmother's, in the attic. When June and Jim got engaged and set up a wedding registry, June told her mother that she was happy to take the family china. Her mother, looking embarrassed, confessed that Kath had broken most of it when she was a teenager. Just gone up to the attic and flung plates and cups and serving dishes against the wall. "You have to eat, Mom," June says again. Her mother takes a tiny sip of soup, a larger sip from the Michelob light at her place. She always seems to have a beer going when June comes by, but it's just the one, as far as June can tell, nursed slowly through the afternoon and evening. She's checked the recycling bins. Her mom is averaging one a day, no more than two. Desperate to do anything, say anything that will rouse her parents from this dull, zombie-like state, June offers, knowing it's premature, "Jim has a lead. Into the, explosion. Someone might be held accountable." To say that her parents brightened would be inaccurate, but their eyes focus on her, hopeful and curious. They want their daughter's death to have meaning. There is no meaning in an accident. But, if Jim is right, Kath's death was still a kind of an accident. The consequence of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. She won't explain that to them just yet. "That woman?" her mother asks. "She's connected. There will be time enough, assuming Jim is right, to tell them the full story. But if his information is correct, it would have been someone else who actually did it." Since that woman, June, like her mother prefers not to use her name, confided in Jim, he has been almost distressingly excited, talking about how much it will mean for his career if he can link Kath's death to similar arson cases in Baltimore. It's unseemly, that's the word, how Jim is more focused on his future than on justice for Kath. June blames that woman. She does something to men. She took Kath's boyfriend from her. She bewitched Mr. C into giving her preferential treatment over Kath, which makes no sense. Good Lord, Mr. C has known June and Kath since they were kids. And he had the soft-serve ice cream place on Main Street. And now that woman has Jim convinced that she can help him solve the mystery of Kath's death. It's not sexual. Not exactly. She's a pot simmering full of promises. Pot! June realizes she has left the electric burner on under the soup, and she goes over, turns it off. She pours the uneaten portion into Tupperware, puts it in the fridge, notices all the Tupperware from her last couple of visits. The crisper drawer is full of rotting vegetables, and the milk has gone bad. Dutiful daughter that she is, she begins throwing out what can't be saved, rinsing the Tupperware, preparing the dishwasher to run. She boils water for a Nescafe for her drive home, then rummages in the cupboard for sugar. All she can find is the old china sugar bowl from the set that Kath destroyed, filled with sugar cubes. Can sugar go bad? She figures as long as there are no ants crawling in the bowl, it's okay. As she's bolting her coffee over the kitchen sink, she sees what appears to be a flash of orange and black in the backyard sycamore. An oriole is a rare sight in these parts, especially this time of year. And it's probably just a red-winged blackbird, its coloring distorted by the dusk. Still, there's no harm in saying, "Mom, I think I just saw a Baltimore oriole." Her mother doesn't even bother to come to the window. "Well, it's gone now," June says with staunch cheer. "But I swear I saw one." She will give her mother binoculars for Christmas, she decides, or introduce her to a new hobby. Or they could find something to collect together, maybe those cute little beanie babies. June leaves her parents in the den watching murders, she wrote. She worries a little about them watching crime shows, but it was always their favorite program. Maybe it's a good sign that they still want to visit Cabot Cove and follow J.B. Fletcher on her various trips. Murder in J.B. Fletcher's world is almost gentle, bloodless. And there's no follow-up, no future visits from J.B. Fletcher, in which the bereaved are staring into space, indifferent to food, conversation, or even a possible Baltimore Oriole sighting. Chapter 31. Adam is pulling roasted bones from the oven when it first occurs to him to wonder if Polly could be cheating on him. How has he gotten here from chopping carrots and celery to questioning her fidelity? He takes a second, traces his chain of thought back to its source. He is making stock, and that's one letter off from taking stock. Taking stock is taking inventory. At least he assumes that's where that usage started. But most people now use it as a term for checking in on their own lives. Where am I? What do I have? What do I lack? Adam is in a job with no future or money, in love with a woman he can't trust. At a critical moment, he lied to protect her. But maybe she didn't need his protection. The fire was ruled an accident, as was Kath's death. Polly has done nothing in recent weeks to suggest she's not worthy of his trust. Although, there was the day she borrowed his truck and put 200 miles on it when it should have been more like 100. She later said that she went to Dover to get a Delaware driver's license. Turns out whoever told her that she could use her birth certificate was wrong, because she needed proof of residence, too. 6 nights ago, she borrowed his truck again, a Tuesday. They both had the evening off, and she suddenly announced she was going to go shopping at the outlet malls on Route 50, almost an hour away. She came home empty-handed. Nothing looked right, she said. I hate this year's styles. Then, this morning, she went to Winterthur, some old estate near Wilmington. She showed him the flyer over the weekend, saying, the bus leaves from the mall at Dover at 9 sharp, comes back at 6. Doesn't a trip like that make more sense in the summer, when the gardens are in full bloom? I want to see the paintings, she said. I like art. News to him. But this morning he drove her to the parking lot at the mall, near the entrance to the Bon Ton, and watched her get on the bus. He thought about staying until the bus headed out, but how paranoid can a guy be? She was sitting in a window seat near the front, wearing a yellow dress with a jacket, a thrift store find. She's right. Old clothes, pieces from the 1950s, suit her better than new ones. She looked excited, but was trying to rein it in, act cool. Excited to go to some old house. Now, back in the kitchen at the Hi-Ho, he reminds himself that the smallest things are new to her. You could argue she's been a prisoner since she was 17. Half her life. Married to an abusive fuck, jail. Rebounding into another unhappy marriage, probably because she was broke. No wonder she seems content in Belleville. Getting up, going to a job she doesn't mind. Pulling drafts for Max and Ernest. Serving his food, which she never ceases to praise. He remembers the grilled cheese he made for her, back when he was wooing her. Was he wooing her then, or just trying to do his job? He could no longer remember how the job faded away when he first started loving her. Maybe he should add that sandwich to the menu. Not with tomatoes, they're out of season, but bacon and cheese never go out of style. He needs better bread, whole grain, high quality. Better bread means a better baker. Not on site, but as a supplier. The one place in town, it can produce the quantities he needs, but it's mediocre. Fine for desserts and cakes, but its breads and rolls are clearly an afterthought. What this restaurant really needs is biscuits, good ones, served piping hot. Everybody loves biscuits, and although no baker, Adam can make those with ease. Except, he doesn't want to be here, on a highway in Delaware, thinking about biscuits. He feels his world shrinking, rescaling itself to fit this town, this life. Just because she's happy here doesn't mean she couldn't be happier still in a larger, grander life. He wants to take her to Botswana, show her a leopard lolling in a tree, feed her real mole in Puebla, or fish tacos at a place he knows in Santa Barbara. They're making love with less frequency. She started to stay up late reading, not coming to bed, waiting him out. And he's too proud to ask. If she doesn't want to be with him, okay then. But she was so cute this morning in her yellow dress, sitting on the bus. Another lady going to Winterthur. He glances at the clock. He has to drive back up to Dover to pick her up at 6. When he pulls into the parking lot, he's 15 minutes ahead of the bus's scheduled arrival. To his amazement, she's there, sitting on a bench, outside the mall. "I told you 5, she says, a little peeved, a tone she almost never takes with him. "I've been sitting here for an hour." "No," he says, "I'm sure it was 6. "Winterthur is at least an hour away." "No harm, no foul. I was just worried about you." That feeling when someone isn't where you expect them to be. "Anyway, it's a pretty night, and I loved Winterthur. I met the nicest lady on the bus who lives up here. She asked me if I wanted to be in her book club. I told her I didn't have a car, but maybe I should get one. Used, we'll see." Just like that, the fight over his lateness is forgotten. Polly doesn't go in for sulks. He made a mistake, although he's absolutely sure she said to pick her up at 6, and she let it go right away. She doesn't pout or try the silent treatment. Of course, it would be hard to notice that Polly gave you the silent treatment. She's not one to chatter. In the early days, he found that restful, but now it unnerves him. There was an Elvis Costello song a few years back about his grandmother who had Alzheimer's. "What goes on in that something-something head of yours?" Adam can remember the meter, but not the words. "What goes on, something, something in the dark." Butter literally might not melt in Polly's mouth. She's that cool, that quick thinking. That cool, that quick thinking. Tonight she's unusually lively. Funny, he never noticed her longing for female company or museum trips. But the Winterthur visit seems to have jazzed her up. She doesn't want to be with a book tonight, that's for sure. And she laughs while they're making love, not in a mean way, simply flushed and happy. After, she starts to talk again about opening a bed and breakfast, maybe in one of the old Victorian houses near downtown. He flashes on her, in the window of the bus, how she looked like a kid on the first day of school, tight with nerves trying to conceal them. It is touching how little she wants. But does he love her enough to stay here? Restless as he's feeling. How can anyone want to stay in Belleville, where the best scenic view is the sun setting over the cornfields? It's small enough to be boring, big enough to be charmless. No, my handsome Pollio, I do not want to run a B&B here. That night, as she sleeps, he goes through her purse. He finds nothing. How do you go to a place like Winterthur and not have a brochure, a ticket? A receipt for a cup of coffee. Her purse has an old-fashioned wallet, another thrift store find, a lipstick, a hairbrush, 2 pens, and a tiny notebook. He opens this, sees a list of numbers, dates, accounts. Dates, he thinks, from the 1980s. She has jotted down a series of dates that, best he can tell, correspond to the final months of her marriage. "Where did you go, my handsome Pollio?" Chapter 32. Pauline Dittmars walks through Irving Lowenstein's front door the Tuesday after Yom Kippur, bold as brass. She's wearing a dress the color of marigolds and a lightweight, nubby wool coat, her hair piled on top of her head, like she thinks she's Audrey Hepburn. She even has gloves. "So," he says, "the mountain came to Muhammad." I think we both know you're the mountain here. And I'm no Mohammed. I'm not even sure I know who Mohammed was. Noting Susie's interest in the visitor, Irving takes Pauline into the back. By any objective standard, she's more attractive than she was when Dittmars was alive. Thinner, less defeated-looking. But he preferred her as she used to be. And it's not just because of what he knows now about her proclivities. Still, he has to admit that yellow, the color used for warnings and caution, suits her. Why are you here? No reason not to be blunt. He has nothing to hide. Adam Bosk, on the other hand, has probably concealed his connection to Irving. That's why he was so happy to be fired as of Labor Day. He tried to make it like he was quitting, but all he did was save Irving the trouble of saying those words. I'm here to make amends. I'm in a 12-step program now, and that's one of the steps. Irving assumes most Gentile women drink, but he doesn't remember that being Pauline's problem. Lord knows her husband was the worst. Drink, cocaine, pills, whatever. Whereas Irving drinks only a little Schlivovitz, maybe 3 times a year. You gonna give me some money? Because you owe me. Even your husband, horrible as he was, knew to kick back something when he used someone. He sees a flash of anger, something the old Pauline never allowed herself to show. Interesting reaction for a woman trying to make amends. I didn't take that money from you. I took it from an insurance company. And it was to care for my daughter. But if I asked Dittmars to sit for a medical exam, you know he wouldn't have done it. Not because he suspected anything, but because anything I asked for, he said no. It was only a matter of time before he killed me, and then what would have happened to Joy? He would have put her in some horrible, cheap institution. She ended up in an institution anyway. In a good one. Paid for with that money. That's how I justified it. As I said, I didn't see how I was hurting another person. I was investigated by the state insurance board, which wasn't exactly good for my business. And your husband got hurt, didn't he? I mean, I think it must hurt to have someone drive a knife through your heart. It's not exactly a mercy killing. There it is again, a flash of anger, at odds with her penitence. You know better than anyone what he was capable of. How many people do you figure he killed while he was on your payroll? Irving holds up his hands as if to stop a car coming toward him in a crosswalk. Hey, I don't know any such thing. I don't know where you get your ideas. For one, he wasn't on my payroll. He worked for someone else. Glancing down, he notices a stain on his shirt. Coffee from his breakfast. Bertie never would have allowed him to go out of the house like this. It bothers Irving that he's been walking around with a stain, even if the only people he's seen all morning are Susie and Pauline. She looks good, Pauline. Healthy, rested, all buffed up with love. Adam Bosk is a schmuck, but it's hard to blame him. He told me everything, Irving. To scare me, to keep me in line. You arrange the policies. As a broker, you could spread them among several companies disguising the pattern. And it wasn't always property, right? Sometimes the guy, what was his name? Ford? He took out life insurance policies on his own people. Then bought them back at a fraction of face value. He got the idea from you, right? Maybe Dittmars did beat you. I think you got brain damage. No, I'm smarter than ever, wised up. Now I see I should have made a deal with you. Offered to give you a percentage instead of rewarding you with that sad little screw in my kitchen. It's strange how much that hurts. He's known for a long time that she used him, but he still thought it might have been pleasant for her. Dittmars was no prize. Irving, in his youth. Well, not his youth, but he was 10 years younger then, well-preserved, meticulous in his hygiene. He had prided himself on being a very thoughtful lover. Bertie never had any complaints. She was an animal, this one. The kind that devours her male partner immediately after rutting. Again, you have a strange way of making amends. She lowers her gaze, seemingly contrite. I'm sorry. It's harder than it might sound, saying you were wrong, taking responsibility, putting other things aside. I should have offered you a cut. That's how it worked. I knew that. A pause. I almost feel as if I need to make amends for Dittmar's. He cut you out sometimes. How so? He asks, adding quickly, not that there was anything to be cut out of, but he talked behind my back. It was one of the last fires, he said. He said that you and the other guy, what was his name? I don't know what you're talking about. He bragged how they cut you out. They cut you out a lot, went to other insurance brokers. That guy, the drug dealer, he saw that he could buy properties cheap, take out policies, then let Dittmar's burn them down. Did you know that? Anyway, the last fire, the one that Dittmar's modeled after a real fire he had investigated, open the gas jets, light a candle, was just meant to damage the house, as I understand it. He didn't know about the girl sleeping upstairs with her baby. He was haunted by that. He tried to tell himself that they died from smoke inhalation, but the autopsy couldn't rule out that they had been killed by all that flying debris. That was on Utah, I think. Paca, Irving says. Hard to forget, Paca. He wished they had cut him out of that one. Pauline killed Dittmar's 2 months later. If only she had done it sooner, Paca never would have happened. Right. Paca. Winter. 1986. A 15-year-old girl and her baby blown sky high. They weren't supposed to be there. It was supposed to be a quick and dirty job, a complete loss on the house, so what was his name? Irving doesn't provide it. Whatever happened to him, that guy? Still don't know what you're talking about. And neither do you, Pauline, so be careful. That's my friendly advice. Don't go around talking about these things. Because some people might wonder how deep you were in it. So, Pauline says, rising to her feet, I'm sorry I deceived you. We okay now? I'm not sure. You hurt my business there for a while. That agent never worked with me again. But you're doing okay. She glances around at his less than impressive surroundings, and he feels an instinct quite foreign to him to justify himself. I'm fine, he says. A rich man by anyone's measure. What about you? Poor as a church mouse, whatever that means. Working as a waitress, it's hard starting over. That why you got a drinking problem? Who says I have a drinking problem? You said you were in a 12-step program. But I didn't say it was for drinking. And, you know, we're supposed to be anonymous. In fact, I can't figure that part out. How can I be anonymous and make amends to those I've wronged? Where are you living these days? As if he didn't know. She smiles, doesn't answer. She was always shrewd, this one. He walks up front with her, stops to confer with Susie, while he watches Pauline head out into the parking lot. Plenty of spaces in front, but she turns to the right and is quickly out of sight. Did Adam drive her here? What was her real agenda? The one thing Irving is sure of is that it's not a 12-step program because they don't have those for lying nafkas. Chapter 33. Halloween falls on a Tuesday this year, which means a long build-up to the holiday, starting with a bonfire on Friday night. Bonfires are a big deal in Belleville. Polly finds this charming, but Adam says it's just proof what a hick town it is. The site is still smoldering when they drive by late that night after work. They get out and inspect the remains, enjoying the heat in the cool October air. Polly, holding her hands toward the embers, tells him, there was a movie I saw once. I think it was set in Paris. A man kills a woman. It's not exactly an accident. But it's also not exactly his fault. He's going mad. Anyway, it's the night of a big bonfire, in which people bring anything they want and throw it on the pile. He wraps up the body in a carpet and throws it on the fire, then runs away. But he still gets caught. Something to do with an earring, I think. Adam doesn't seem particularly interested, but she finds she can't stop herself. It was on Picture for a Sunday Afternoon. Oh, I forgot. You didn't grow up in Baltimore. That was a local thing, Picture for a Sunday Afternoon. Which sounds kind of churchy and nice, but it was amazing the movies they showed sometimes. Horror movies. The Leech Woman was a big favorite of mine. She stayed youthful forever by killing men and drinking their blood, but then she killed a woman and the spell reversed itself. They also showed women in prison movies. She laughs. Go figure, those weren't exactly factual. Polly waits to see if Adam will offer a corresponding story about his childhood, but he doesn't. It's rare for either of them to talk about the past. It's not something they agreed on, merely a pattern that emerged. Once all the secrets, well, most of the secrets, were out in the open, there was no reason to talk about the past. What does she know about Adam? He went to college in Ohio, then attended some famous cooking school in New York, although he didn't graduate. Went from there to working on a yacht, first as a deckhand. Ended up as the chef. He grew up in the Bay Area. His parents are dead. He liked them a lot, especially his mother. What does he know about her? Not as much as he thinks he does. Suddenly, it is important to her to let him know that she had a nice childhood, too, warm and safe as his. Her parents were good people, much too nice to prepare their daughter for a world of people like Dietmars and Irving and that guy they worked with. On Sunday afternoons, my mom ironed in front of the television in her bedroom. It smelled so good. You know that smell? Scorchy and warm. She had a bottle that she filled with water for the things that needed to be ironed on the steam setting. She put some kind of scent in it. I don't think it was made to be a sprinkle bottle for ironing. There was a tiny picture of a woman on it, but it was starting to flake off. If I could have one thing of my mom's, it would be that bottle. I don't know what happened to it when she moved to Florida. Better not to mention that Polly was in prison at the time, that her mother died in Florida of a broken heart. All Adam says is, I don't think I've ever seen you iron. If I had her sprinkle bottle, I think I would. I wish I had her sprinkle bottle, and this one bracelet she had, with these flat glass beads with pieces of peacock feathers set inside. My mother loved Halloween. She liked scary movies, too. She would let me watch anything. But then it's not like anything really scary came on TV back then. I remember House of Wax and She. Remember She? Who? The movie, She. There's a beautiful woman who's hundreds of years old. She invites a man to bathe in this fire that makes you immortal. But it turns out that if you go into the fire twice, the spell reverses, and you age to your real age. She turns into a skeleton, dies, reaching for him. So, he's immortal now, but he's betrayed everyone, and she's gone. He's going to live forever, but alone. Adam puts an arm around her, hugs her closer. I think Halloween's making you morbid. Let's go home. On Tuesday night, actual Halloween, Polly dresses all in black in a 1950s cocktail dress unearthed at the church rummage sale a few weeks ago. She has bags and bags of candy. Miniature Hershey bars, Reese's cups, small boxes of dots, because there's always some weird kid who doesn't like chocolate. But the trick-or-treaters don't seem to realize that someone lives in the garage apartment, and they skip her door. She hopes that's the reason the kids skip her door. Adam, she says, the wooden bowl of candy in her lap. Do you think people gossip about us? About me? What do you mean? About my life, what I did before I moved here? A beat. How Kath died? If they do, there's nothing you can do about it. so it's best not to think about it. Do you ever think about it? What? In her black dress, black gloves, and retro heels, she looks like Joan Crawford or Betty Davis. She feels like them, too, tough, yet brittle. That's the thing about being really hard. When you do break, you shatter. Not even 10 years ago, I fed my husband one of his favorite dinners. Turkey and scalloped potatoes, lots of beer, a pie. He didn't like the pie because I didn't have any ice cream, only whipped cream. Fresh whipped cream, whipped by hand. I knew the turkey would make him sleepy, but I couldn't trust it to do the entire job. So I crushed up some sleeping pills, added them to the cheese sauce on the potatoes to make sure he would be drowsy. Then, when he was asleep, lying on his back, I stood next to the bed. "I know all this," Adam says. He's not meeting her eyes. "You told me. Maybe not in such detail. I stabbed him through his heart, Adam. Through his heart. I studied for weeks, making sure I knew where to aim. I had one chance to save myself and my kid. He was going to kill me. When he did, I knew there was no one who would care for Joy. What's got into you tonight? I was looking forward to the kids coming to the door. We didn't get many trick-or-treaters on Kentucky back in the day." She waits to see if he will ask her about this. He doesn't. "Do you think people think I killed Kath?" "It was ruled an accident." His eyes are fixed on the television. "He bought it 3 weeks ago. She hates it. First, she loses her beautiful apartment, and now this thing has invaded. Adam and Eve didn't need to be forced out of Eden, Polly thinks. All God had to do was send down a 27-inch color television and a cable box. Adam's using the remote to toggle back and forth between a hockey game and a CNN report that a passerby has been subpoenaed to testify about finding Vincent Foster's body. She drops two words from her question. "Do you think I killed Kath?" Someone shoots a goal, and he gives a short guffaw of approval. Hockey. He watches hockey. She was never one of those people who have lists, questionnaires, to hand out at the beginning of a relationship. She never had the luxury of looking for a relationship, someone who would please her. If she had, she might have remembered to ask, "How many hours a week do you watch sports? Do you care so much that you mope around when your favorite team loses?" Dittmars did that, of course. Greg didn't really feel passionate about any team, which seemed not very masculine to Polly. Adam, at least, cares but doesn't take it personally when his team is defeated. She stands up, begins to shimmy out of her clothes, not trying to divert him. Quite the opposite. This isn't a striptease, it's a disappearing act. Goodbye, Joan Crawford. Hello, Polly. She drifts toward their bedroom, pale and cold as a ghost. Within 5 minutes, the set clicks off, and he is in bed with her. They both play it savage tonight. She pulls his hair, bites him hard. And when he's done, and she's still on top of him, she braces herself with her arms on either side of his ears, so he couldn't look away if he wanted to. "Do you think I killed Kath?" He doesn't answer right away, which she likes. A lie would come quickly. He should have to think about this. He has avoided thinking about it all these weeks. That morning when they came onto the accident scene when he agreed she had reached his place by midnight, he might have been confused, nothing more. It could have been an honest mistake. But if he did lie, it was for love of her. And that kind of love can turn. "I've wandered," he admits, "because of my past. Because she was in your apartment and there was a freak accident. It's quite the coincidence." "Coincidences happen all the time." "That's true." His tone is agreeable, but that doesn't mean he's agreeing. She lets it go. Soon enough, he'll see how wrong he was. Chapter 34. Bob Riley is eating a turkey sub, extra hots, and thinking about his next week's picks when he notices a new customer, a stranger, walking into Video American. Not that Bob knows every VA customer, but most of the customers know him, greet him by name, or rather, the name he uses on his shelf talkers. Baba O'Reilly. Bob's, Baba's, staff picks have earned him a following, mainly with guys. The idea of cults growing up around a staffer's recommendations has gone so mainstream that Seinfeld even did an episode about it. But Bob likes to think his picks have an oblique wit that rewards the people who really get him. He's not obscure or arty, but his choices are clever, no obvious or literal connections, similar to the best mixtapes. This week, for example, he's featuring Songwriter and Payday. Everybody, well, the kind of everybody who rents from Video American, knows Payday, and most of them know Alan Rudolph, although he never lived up to the promise of his early stuff. And even people who love Choose Me and Trouble in Mind seem to have missed Songwriter. Part of it, Bob thinks, is the entrenched snobbery about country music, which shows how ignorant people in the Northeast can be. They think country music is what's on the radio right now, Alan Jackson and Tracy Lawrence and Reba McEntire. They've never listened to Johnny Cash, much less bluegrass. Alison Krauss is fine, but what about Marty Stewart? People mock him for the hair and the sequins, but he's only the best mandolin player ever. He was even in Cash's band for a while. Johnny Cash. Bob wishes Cash would act more. Have the old Columbo episodes even been released on VHS? He could add the season with Swan Song, featuring Cash as one of the best Columbo villains ever. Because you can tell Columbo kind of feels for the guy. Gets that he got a raw deal. If he had killed just the harridan of a wife in the plane crash, instead of taking out the wife and the girl, the Cash character would have been almost heroic. Bob goes over to the television section, which is not his specialty, but no luck. There are not a lot of old television shows on VHS. People don't want to rent things they once saw for free. The new customer is browsing the mystery section, clearly trying to figure out the store's classification system, which is deliberately offbeat. Bob scored a job here 2 years ago, which gives the guy some bragging rights in Newark. The owner won't hire just anyone. There's a 100-question test, and film knowledge isn't enough. You have to have people skills, too. A lot of would-be hires ace the test and fail the customer relations part of the interview. They can tell you every film that Bernard Herrmann scored, but they can't make eye contact with a human being. "I'm looking for a movie," the guy finally admits to Bob. He's probably the kind of man who doesn't like to ask for directions unless he's desperate. Bob gestures at the walls with his sandwich. "I think we got you covered." The man smiles. He's got a Sergio Leone Man with No Name vibe. You can almost hear the Morricone music coming up. Is he the good or the bad? He's definitely not ugly. Bob's always a little confused, as most men are, about what women find attractive, but he figures this guy checks all the boxes. Tall, with broad shoulders, strong jaw, pale blue eyes, olive skin. Sort of James Caan, crossed with Paul Newman. Bob is medium height and lanky with sandy hair, not a hunchback, but not swoon-worthy on first sight. "I'm looking for a movie that my..." Long pause, as if he's lost his train of thought. "That my girlfriend described to me. Only she doesn't know the title or the stars." Bob doesn't sigh, not even inwardly. On a slow afternoon, this kind of challenge is what he loves. "Does she remember when she saw it in the theater?" A year would help narrow it down plenty. "She saw it on television when she was growing up in Baltimore. So, I'm guessing it's older, 50s, no later than 60s. Black and white. I didn't ask, but My hunch is that her family had a black and white set, so she wouldn't know. The guy has the self-awareness to be chagrined. She did remember one scene in vivid detail. "Have at me," Bob says. "Graduated UT Austin 6 years ago with a film degree. Still unclear how I ended up in the land of the Blue Hen." The Blue Hen? That's the mascot for University of Delaware. "I've gone from hook 'em horns," he does the fingers, "to who gives a cluck." The guy's smile is polite, but he's clearly not much on small talk. Anyway, all she remembers is that it's in Paris and there's a bonfire. A man has killed a woman, but maybe it's by accident. Or she deserves it. And it happens that there's a big bonfire that night, so he rolls her body up in a carpet and goes out, throws the body in the bonfire. Does he get away with it? What? In the movie, does his plan work? I don't remember, I just thought. Well, I thought it would make an impression if I found this movie she was talking about. This smile feels more genuine. At least it would prove that I'm listening to her, right? Bob nods as if he has as much experience with women as this older man. He hasn't had a girlfriend for 18 months. He's dated here and there, but his job is a catch-22 when it comes to a social life. Women want to date Baba O'Reilly at Video American. But if he wants weekends off, he can't be Baba O'Reilly at Video American. He's going to be Bob Riley again. This guy could probably get women if he worked the midnight shift at the sanitation department. Did you say Paris? Yeah. Could the guy be a musician? He shrugs. Paris, a bonfire. Something is flicking Bob's imagination. He can almost hear the movie's soundtrack in his ear. Bernard Herrmann. He's hearing Bernard Herrmann, but not this film. Yet he's also seeing an actress who is integral to a pretty famous film with a Herrmann score. Are you sure it's Paris? I'm not sure of anything. Bob pages through some of the video guides they keep behind the counter. His mind is racing along, hearing music again. But this time he finally identified it. The score of My Darling Clementine. Everything clicks into place, cylinders sliding into a tumbler. My Darling Clementine, Chihuahua, Linda Darnell, with her pout and her put-upon act. Hangover Square, he says, snapping his fingers, as pleased with himself as if he were a doctor solving a medical mystery. Not Paris, London. It's whatever that day is in England when they celebrate that guy not blowing things up. Guy Fawkes Day. The customer says. So, do you have it? I'm not even sure it's out on video. The director didn't have much of a career, I don't think, but if you really want it, I can look into it. I live downstate, in Belleville, almost an hour's drive. If I opened an account, could I overnight the movies back to you? There's nothing near us like this, of course, but that pause again. Girlfriend, she likes old movies, obscure ones. Clearly. But as for mailing the movies back, all I can give you is a very flabby maybe. I'd have to ask the owner. We take a credit card for all accounts. You lose a movie, we charge your card. But I've never had anyone ask if they could mail it back. I know this much. If it got lost in the mail, that would be your problem. As you said, you don't even have it in stock, but if you find it, yeah, I'd like to know. He takes out his Visa card, fills out the paperwork. Bob can't help noticing he lists his home address as Baltimore, which has its own Video American. As he's finishing up, he asks, "What about She?" "Who?" "She, the movie." "Do you have that?" "Oh, Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, Ursula Andress. That might be in." He finds it in General Horror, which strikes him as sloppy. They should have a Christopher Lee shelf. "Another kind of bonfire movie," he says. "Your girlfriend have a thing for fires?" The guy's smile flickers slow like neon blinking before it reaches full tilt. You know, I should probably wait to check this out until I find out what it's going to cost me to mail these back overnight. I work almost every day. Who doesn't? Bob asks, agreeably. Is there, like, a vintage store nearby with household items? Household items? I'm looking for an old sprinkler bottle. The kind women used to use to wet down clothes when they ironed. My girlfriend talks about how much she wishes she had one. She likes to iron and watch old movies. Dude, you have hit the jackpot. Does she have a sister? I have no idea. Chapter 35. Polly pulls two drafts for Max and Ernest. The hi-ho is quiet tonight. It's quiet almost every night now. The youngish couples in town might come in on Fridays and Saturdays, but weeknights are slow. Adam has been making old-fashioned comfort food, brisket, and chicken pot pies and what locals call Maryland stew. But it is, as he keeps pointing out, a small town. That's why they need to make the restaurant a destination unto itself. She has been reading up on a restaurant hotel in Virginia, the Inn at Little Washington. It opened in a garage in 1978, and, in less than 10 years, became the first restaurant to earn 5 diamonds from AAA. They could do that here if they had some cash. You don't have to have water views to have a successful inn if the restaurant's good enough. Meanwhile, Mr. C seems to be getting whiter and whiter with each passing day. Adam is careful with the budget, and the kitchen doesn't cost that much more to run than it did when it was all hamburgers and chili and frozen French fries. But the biggest line item is Adam. Mr. C doesn't want to go back to cooking. And if he does, it won't be like Adam's cooking. Whatever reputation the hi-ho has earned over the past few months will be lost. Maybe the townies won't complain, and come summer the tourists won't know it ever took a downturn. But Polly can almost see the wheels turning behind Mr. C's ghostly white face. Can he get Adam back if he turns him loose? What happens to Polly if Adam leaves? Yes, what happens to Polly? She stayed here for Adam, gave up Reno and her quickie divorce. Will he stay here for her? Max and Ernest liked the bar in its near-deserted state. They were unhappy when the restaurant section was filled with noisy diners, out-of-towners who said things like, "Does the television have to be on?" and "Is the corn Silver Queen?" They mocked the specialty drinks the non-locals ordered, things that Polly had never heard of, like a cocktail made with vodka, Cointreau, cranberry juice, and lime. Polly never minded learning how to make a new drink, but Max and Ernest resented these requests. It was their bar. Polly was their bartender. Now they have the bar and Polly back, all to themselves, hip hip hooray. And they still don't tip her well. They seem to think their company is compensation enough. It's not. Especially given their obsession with politics, a topic that bores Polly silly. The last few days, all they want to talk about is Delaware's attempt to encroach on the New Hampshire primary in February. The plan has backfired, and politicians are now falling in line with New Hampshire's demand that candidates skip the Delaware primary or rue the day. Dole, the Republican frontrunner, has pulled out of Delaware. Max and Ernest are outraged on behalf of Delaware, which they note is officially the first state, the first to ratify the U.S. Constitution. Why shouldn't they have the first primary? "Why is everyone kowtowing to the Granite State?" Ernest says. "What's so great about New Hampshire?" "I like its state motto," Polly says. "Live free or die." They pay her no heed. She's not supposed to insert herself into their serious discussions, only indulge their jokes. She knows that. But she feels ornery tonight. If you ask me, small states are like small men. Big chips on their shoulders. Something to prove. Also, wasn't New Hampshire's claim to fame that every president first won his party's primary there? "Not Bill Clinton," Max says. "Oh, right. Hillary Clinton on 60 Minutes, eating humble pie because she dared to say she wouldn't bake cookies and stand by her man. Polly had watched that with Greg, whose only comment was, "I wouldn't fuck her." "Slick Willie," Ernest mutters darkly. "I wonder if we'll be stuck with him for another 4 years." "Clinton," Max says, "a sweet talker. How I hate a sweet talker." "They're all alike," Polly says. They assume she means politicians, so they nod. Mr. C comes in just after the kitchen closes, most unusual. Sure enough, he summons Adam and Polly to the office.
"I'm bleeding money here," he says. "I never kept a cook past Labor Day before. I always did the cooking myself through the cold months. We just don't do enough business."
"Adam, it's not personal. I know it's not," Adam says. He looks almost relieved, Polly thinks. He wants to go. "What about me?" she asks. The question could be for either man. Mr. C is the one who answers.
"I still need you. But I'll understand if you want to leave. I know how thin the tips have been."
"Yes," she said. "The tips are getting thin." She and Adam don't say a word on the drive home. Adam and Eve on a raft. But where is the raft taking them? What happens when only Adam gets kicked out of Eden, but Eve gets to stay despite being the one that everyone has pegged a sinner? In the weeks since Kath died, Polly has straightened out her name issues, opened accounts. On paper, she is still technically Pauline Hansen. It's easier that way for now. When the divorce comes through, she'll go to Social Security, reclaim her maiden name. And it's simple enough to tell people that Polly is a nickname for Pauline. Simple, because it has the virtue of being true. She has a checking account with her new address on Lilac Way. She's put down roots, shallow as they are. And now they're being ripped up. "What are you going to do?" she asks Adam. "You, not us." She wonders if he notices. But Adam notices everything. Not much gets by him. Not much gets by her, either. "I'm not going to find anything else here," he says. "Not as a cook, but aren't there other things you can do? What were you doing when we met?"
"Oh, I had just finished sailing a boat up from Florida to Rehoboth and was driving back to Maryland."
"I can't remember. How did you end up in Belleville?"
"Car trouble.
My truck threw a rod. Look, what about Annapolis?" he asks. "What about it?"
"There's always work for someone like me. I can find some kind of job to carry us through the winter. You can too.
The legislature will be in session. The local restaurants will be slammed. We'll be together. Isn't that what matters?" "Is it?"
"It is to me."
"I like it here." Her voice is petulant, and she knows it, hates herself for it. She doesn't do petulant. Petulant is for weak women, dependent women. She doesn't need him, even if he's been helping her carry the rent on this place. She wants him, though. Adam is the first man, the first thing she has ever chosen for her own pleasure and delight. That's hard to give up.
"I'll look," Adam says. "But without a paycheck for me, and your tips as small as they are."
Nothing left to do but try to save the evening with a joke. "Hey, there's nothing wrong with my tips." He laughs. Adam is probably a good man, all things considered. She wants to make a life with him. But she had been hoping to make a life here, too. Which will she choose? Is the choice even hers? And maybe Belleville isn't the answer. Maybe she likes it because it felt like a kind of cockeyed destiny. She reminds herself that the plan, back in June, was to find a job, build up a nice little nest egg, then head to Reno. But after Kath died, she feared that leaving would make Adam even more suspicious of her. She should be almost divorced now, her prize within reach. She stayed in Belleville for Adam. Why won't he do the same for her? I love you, she says to Adam. I love you too. That should be enough. Should. The next day he sits down with the penny saver and the news journal. I could commute, he says. If that's what it takes. Work in Baltimore during the week, be here on weekends. But then you'll have the cost of another place. Don't worry, I'll still help with the rent here. I'm not worried. She wonders if he is as exhausted by all the lying as she is. Chapter 36. When Adam crosses his own threshold for the first time in months, he finds himself thinking of a few lines from Kim.